In October 2005, Brian Anderson's life changed forever. While he was on a mission in Iraq, an IED detonated under his Humvee. The explosion cost him his legs and part of his left arm, and he tells that story and how he rebuilt his life in a new memoir he's called No Turning Back. It is published by Berkeley Books, and I'm very pleased to welcome him to our show today. Hello.
Hello. How you doing?
I'm okay. Why did you want to join the military? You signed up before 9/11, didn't you?
I did, yes. It was more of like my life was boring. I was going through everyday daily routine, getting up, going to work. I worked for American Airlines at the time. I loved my job, but it was the daily routine. Get off, go to the same pool hall with the same friends. Never did anything different for a few years, and then it was like, well, I need something different. I need a change.
So did you see yourself as a lifer in the military?
No, I never did. I just kind of wanted to see if I could do it, and I wanted to, you know, do my part, but I knew I was going to get out.
And then you wound up serving two tours of duty in Iraq, all in the Baghdad area?
Actually, the first year we were all over Iraq, and then we came home for 8 months and went back for another year, and that was strictly in Baghdad.
And was it okay for you to go back the second time?
Yeah.
Because some people think, well, you know, I did it, that's enough, and now the Army's asked me to go back, I'd really rather do something else.
I didn't really have a choice. But it was fine for me because all my friends were there, and I wouldn't want to go with anybody else or not go when my friends were there and me not be, you know.
And so many people in the military talk about that, the business of friends and feeling like they're part of a family.
Absolutely.
What kinds of missions were you typically sent on?
Well, the first year, do you remember the top 55 deck of cards? Our job was to go and take those people out of their houses, basically. I mean, it wasn't, you know, that we got all of them or anything, but there were probably five or six different task force tasked to do that mission.
To locate those people who had been the leaders of
right.
Saddam Hussein's government.
Absolutely. So the first year, we were pretty much all over Iraq doing that. And then the second year that we were there, we were, for the first 3 months, police academy instructors. And then after that, we would go out to the Iraqi police stations, hold their hands basically, teach them how to do raids and making sure that they're running their police station correctly and all that.
So the first tour was a lot more dangerous than the second one, in theory.
In theory, you would think.
Did you lose friends in during either of these tours?
The first year we lost two soldiers. One was to a suicide and one was to an RPG. And then the second year out of our battalion we lost 15, and five of them were pretty close to me.
And you lost them through things like IED explosions?
IEDs, gunshots, RPGs, you know, all of the above.
I would assume that you wondered more than once whether you'd come back alive.
Absolutely. But I never thought about coming back halfway. It was always, I'm either going to make it or I'm not. Never thought about it, you know, coming back.
Do you think that's the philosophy most of the
Absolutely.
Soldiers have?
Absolutely. I don't think anybody really thinks about coming back wounded.
Which is the way most are coming back, in fact, in these wars more than anything in the past, because medical science has allowed us to save the lives of so many more people.
Absolutely.
You might have died in a previous war.
I'm sure I would have. Battlefield wounds are being able to, you know, be taken care of on the battlefield enough to get them to the hospital. And then once they get to the hospital, once they get to the hospital, these doctors, these trauma doctors are doing amazing things.
So can you take us through the events that led up to the explosion that cost you your legs and part of your arm?
Sure. I'd actually just gotten back off leave. I'd been there for 2 months after I got back off leave. A month right before that, one of my friends really died, or good friends died. And I wrote an email to like four people, and it was about why them. You know, why are all these good people going and you know, these people that are just not so good people never have anything to worry about. Nothing ever happens to them. It's always the good guys. And so it was kind of like, you know, why not me? Why not that? And then, like, the next day I got blown up.
Well, is there any way to prepare for that? IEDs, are they totally invisible?
Pretty much. The one that got me, if you picture the median between the road, one of our tanks had crossed over it and crushed the curb. So what these insurgents did was they swept it out, measured that, then built a bomb to fit in that section of the curb, plastered it and painted it so that it looked just like one long curb again.
Pretty clever.
So you couldn't even see it, yeah.
When it happened, did everything go into slow-mo as it does in the movies?
Not really.
Were you aware of what was happening?
I was. I was actually talking with my buddy Kenny, who was sitting next to me. And the way you cope with everything in Iraq is you make fun of it. Even if it's the most wrong thing to make fun of, you made fun of it and laughed at it. And we were talking about, you know, our situation, and we were making jokes and stuff. And I actually had both of my hands on the bottom of the steering wheel. My left leg was curled up underneath my right leg, and my right leg down driving. I was actually driving. And I actually pulled my hand off the steering wheel, my right hand, to grab a cigarette. I know it's bad, but I was a smoker. And I put a cigarette in my mouth, and as I went to go light it, it was almost as if me lighting the lighter triggered the bomb, because it happened at the exact same time. I saw the spark from the lighter, the flash from the bomb. The next thing I saw was smoke and fire coming through the door, and then it was pitch black, and that was because there was so much smoke inside the truck, you couldn't see anything that was going on. It didn't knock me out, and I didn't know anything had happened to me yet.
So you didn't know that you were in serious trouble at that point?
No. My first reaction was to look to my right and be like, hey, we got hit, are you guys okay? And I didn't hear anything, and that scared me, but that's because they jumped out immediately, ran to the truck in front of us, looked back, said, Anderson's not out yet, let's go get him. So they came back and got me and pulled me out.
Yeah, you say that in a way, the way that the explosive charge was designed helped save your life.
In a way, yeah, because it got so hot, it kind of cauterized everything. But everything happened instantly. My legs were laying in the floorboard, my hand was in the passenger seat, and it spun me sideways.
Would it have been different if you'd been driving quicker?
I think so. If we would have been driving quicker, I think we all would have been dead. It was because we were going so slow, like 5 miles an hour. When they set off these bombs or set these bombs, they set them to where you're driving at like 35 miles an hour. So they're aimed like that already. So if I was going at 35, it would have hit most of the cab instead of most of the front end of my truck.
They trigger it with a laser?
This one, yes.
Pretty sophisticated.
We had Warlock systems, which are radio frequency jammers, but they only work for 250 yards. Well, we kept a bubble of traffic, or a bubble between us and the traffic. So once all the civilian traffic went by, they clicked that remote detonate thing to set off the laser. So now it has nothing to do with the radio frequencies, and once our tires broke that beam, it blew up.
Well, where do they get that kind of equipment? Does anyone know?
Everywhere. I'm sure they've gotten some of it from us. I'm sure they got a lot from Iran, Syria. I mean, it was like Iraq was a breeding ground to kill an American.
My guest is Brian Anderson, who's written with the help of David Mack, No Turning Back. It has a foreword by Gary Sinise, and it is published by Berkeley. So do you remember much of what happened after the explosion?
I remember everything.
You must have been in terrible pain initially.
Not really, actually.
Was the shock? Do you think the shock eliminates that?
Absolutely. I was definitely in shock. And I still didn't know what had happened to me. At one point, I was inside the truck, and I told myself, all right, get out. And I couldn't get out. I don't know what I did to try to get out, but for some reason I knew I couldn't get out. Then they pulled me out, and I got a really good fresh breath of air, and that kind of revived me made me more alert. And we get onto the sidewalk, and I'm sitting here thinking, all right, we just got attacked. Do I need to be shooting? What do I need to be doing? All I know is I needed to be pulled out of the vehicle. I still didn't know what was going on. Well, I saw my friends running back and forth from me to the truck like they had just seen a ghost, so I knew something was wrong. And that's when I started like assessing myself, and I noticed the first thing that on my right-hand index fingertip was gone. I was like, oh, that's not so bad. And then I turned my hand over, and there's a chunk of my hand that was missing, and I could see into my hand like the shattered bones, the ligaments. It was kind of gross. And as I was looking at that, a fly landed in my eye, and I went to go wipe it away with my left hand, and I just kind of whiffed. And I looked at it, and I went, whoa, I saw my sleeve hanging there. There was a little bit of blood. And that's when I decided to look down. And as I tried to look down, my friends forced my head back down to the ground. But I saw what had happened, and said a few choice words and was like, that did not just happen. I'm dreaming. And it wasn't.
You write that in a lot of ways life is like millions of parallel lines of dominoes, and which ones fall depend on one decision at the start of a long chain of events. So you believe that the decisions you made soon after your accident have affected your quality of life to this day?
Absolutely. I made a decision to, you know, want to have an extraordinary life. I wanted to be a happy person. I didn't want to be depressed and, I got blown up. I wasn't going to be like that. So,
well, you're 26 years old, and you still have a long life ahead of you.
Right.
Or you, at that moment,
at
you
that
were
moment,
26.
I was. Yeah. I'm 30 now, but it was a decision that I said, "All right, I'm going to go figure out, you know, what it's going to be like." I knew my family was behind me, so I was like, "All right, I'm going to go see what I can and can't do." And I started trying things: snowboarding, wakeboarding, sports, all kinds of stuff.
Well, you came in here in a wheelchair, but you can walk on prosthetic legs?
Absolutely.
How different is the act of walking on prosthetic legs than on the legs you had before you were injured?
It's very different. It's almost like walking on stilts with hinges on them. And it just takes practice. It definitely takes practice, and you got to get used to it.
And they don't give you the ones that you're going to wind up with initially. They work you up?
Right. They start you off at like 10 inches, or no, they start you off right at the bottom. So your little feet right at the end of your stumps, and then they grow you like 10 inches, and then they'll grow you another 10 inches, and then you get your full set of legs.
And you say that it's like trying to walk when your legs are asleep.
Yes.
So what about, do we know a lot about how to do physical therapy today with people who've had these kinds of wounds?
I think so. I think they've gotten better at it through the process of all these wounded soldiers coming back. But, yeah, and my biggest thing is you have to get outside the clinic. The clinic is perfect.
Well, in your case, you've got involved in athletics, but there must be an awful lot of people who are who've been through similar experiences who are at home and in bed and saying, why did this ever happen to me? Why me?
Right, right.
Have you talked to them?
I've talked to a few people, and I'm always like, you know, you can't really say, why me? You got to be like, you know what? It happened to you, and you have to accept that fact, and then you can move on.
And you wound up being on the cover of Esquire, even a small role in the rest of the film with Mickey Rourke.
Yes.
How did that happen?
Well, in the Esquire article, it said that I wanted to start acting and being a stuntman, and I started doing a little stuff like that. Douglas Crosby, who was a stunt coordinator out of New York, I believe, gave me the opportunity to work on The Wrestler with them, and it was pretty cool.
I had so a lot now of you're time. Acting?
A little bit,
That's
yes.
How you met Gary Sinise?
Actually, I met Gary Sinise at Walter Reed. I actually tripped into him. I was practicing on my legs, and I tripped. I felt both my hands into his chest. I looked up, and I'm like, holy cow, Gary Sinise. And he's like, holy cow, the real Lieutenant Dan. I was like, no. You'll always be Lieutenant Dan. But that's how we met.
A listener wrote in and asked, your positive attitude about life is truly remarkable given what you've been through, but isn't part of you at all angry that you may have been sent into a battlefield, Iraq, for a cause that turned out to be based on a lie?
No, because when I got there, we made our own reasons for why we were there. When we were sitting in Kuwait right before we invaded, there was all these rumors going around on why we were there, and we were getting a little complacent. Bush is doing it just to retaliate for his dad, or there's chemical weapons, or weapons of mass destruction, or whatever.
Well, you found out that there were no weapons of mass destruction.
Well, right, but in all reality, we gave them some 10 years ago or something, you know? So we knew they had them, we just didn't know where they put them. But once we rolled over that line from Kuwait into Iraq, there was nothing but women and children lining the streets for miles, so thankful, screaming and cheering that we were there to do something. And every so often you see a little mud hut, and it's obviously where these people are living, and there's no way in this day and age anybody should have to live like that.
So why do you think they're so angry with us today?
I don't think they are. I think, well, the ones that are, they were happy that we were there to take out Saddam. And then we took out Saddam, and they didn't understand why we were staying. They were like, okay, you did your job, so why are you still here? And it's like, well, because we don't want somebody to just do it all over.
Brian Anderson is an advocate for veterans. He participated in the National Veteran Wheelchair Games and won gold medals in archery and table tennis. He's written a book called No Turning Back. It is published by Berkeley. Thank you so much for being with us.
No problem. Thank you so much for having me.